it's Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico. I'm really delighted that our guest this week is my friend and someone who knows Russia much better than I do, Julia Yaffe. She is an author. She's writing a book she can tell us about Russia. She's a contributor to The Atlantic, and she is one of the smartest Russia hounds in Washington today. Julia, thank you for finally being on the Global Politico.
Thank you for having me. That was quite a fulsome introduction.
Excellent. Fulsome
is... You're making me blush.
Fulsome is what I was aiming for. But I have to say, first of all, I need to make a little announcement of my own because it will help to explain what this episode of the Global Politico is about. So this will be not our last, but our second to last episode of the Global Politico, at least with me as the host. It may go on a bit of a hiatus, but I'm going to make a little bit of a career change and work full-time at The New Yorker as a staff writer. I'll be contributing to their New Yorker radio hour. But the Global Politico, in its current iteration, sadly, will only have this episode and the next episode. And I thought, given that we really ought to devote the full conversation today to Russia. It's been an ongoing theme ever since we launched the Global Politico. We launched the Global Politico within days of Donald Trump's inauguration last year in 2017. And the idea was really to help make sense of this disrupted world and what kind of a foreign policy was Donald Trump going to have. We all knew that it would be different than what came before. And every week it's been sort of variations on a theme of just how different has it been. And yet throughout that, the consistency with which we've talked about Russia, not only, of course, because I was a former correspondent in Moscow, but because it has been a theme in many ways, both of the politics of the Trump administration with the Russiagate investigation still underway, but also because it has remained sort of the most perplexing foreign policy question. Donald Trump to this day has never personally moved beyond his public admiration for Vladimir Putin, his praise for him, and yet his administration has, you know, talked tough, has really undertaken a policy toward Russia that isn't all that different from what a Democratic or a Republican administration might do faced with the same set of facts. So the conundrum of trying to understand what the heck is going on with Russia has remained, you know, this enduring obsession. So we've had many great episodes about Russia. We'll talk about some of those today, some of the highlights, and Julia and I will try to make sense of it. One of the things, right, Julia, that from the beginning has been so weird about Trump and Russia is that on the one hand, Washington has never been more obsessed with Russia in some ways. And yet it's very ignorant about Russia too. So how do you square that circle? You were born in Russia. You immigrated here. You then returned after you graduated from college as a working journalist to Moscow.
To work for you.
At Foreign Policy. And then you came back here to Washington. So we're kind of unusual in that we both have covered both Washington and Moscow. That's not true of all that many people. What do you make of Washington's Russia obsession these days?
Well, personally, I find it deeply frustrating. It's one of those cases where, you know, what are we talking about when we talk about Russia? And usually the answer is not Russia, but we're talking about ourselves in the same way that when Russians obsess about America, they're not really obsessing about America. They're obsessing about themselves, but refract it through this external lens. And it's funny to see this country described as this kind of Bondian nexus of evil where everything is super organized. Putin is this master strategist who just has everything planned out from A to Z and is able to follow through piece by piece on his strategy or on his agenda, and that everything is just – I mean, it's basically the Soviet Union mixed with the Americans, mixed with, you know, some James Bond. And I don't know about you. You spent a lot of time there too. I don't recognize that Russia, you know. Well, it's a lot – the Russia I know is a lot more like Arrested Development, you know, mixed with some James Bond stuff, right? It's a lot of things. And I think I sometimes overcompensate in the other direction where I'm like, guys, they're just not that good. They're not that competent.
Well, this is a great starting point, actually, for sort of our first segment of our conversation today, which is about the Russia as it actually is. And what do we really think about Vladimir Putin now that he has just gotten another six-year term? He's already been in power for 18 years. He's already, in fact, become the longest-serving Russian leader since Joseph Stalin. So I picked out a few of our interviews over the last year on the Global Politico that really go to this question of, are we really talking about Russia as it actually exists today? And it was Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former Russian wealthiest man who was then imprisoned by Vladimir Putin, now a dissident who lives in London. He called it this myth of the great and horrible Putin.
I'm working in my office. I've got a boss who tells me what to do. He's got a boss who tells him what to do. And above him is another boss who probably is telling my boss in the same way, or my boss's boss in the same way, what to do. In actuality, this is not the way things work. Management science says that that kind of a chain doesn't work more than three levels up. But who knows that? And that's why people so easily accept this myth about this great and horrible Putin.
Which is so interesting because he lost a decade of his life to this horrible Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin was, in fact, very horrible to Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And Vladimir Putin is horrible in a lot of ways. But here, you know, if you read the discussion or you listen to the discussion about Russia, you're not hearing about those ways. And again, I think, as you and I have talked about a lot, it's a lot about how we imagine our adversary as Americans. And for somebody to be able to come in and mess with our elections or to stymie us in geopolitics and take over our traditional kind of, I hate to use this term, spheres of influence, they have to be a really mighty enemy, right? They have to be really, really good. Otherwise, are we not very good if we're stymied by some kind of tin pot dictator, banana republic, where, you know, things are kind of held together with shoelaces and gum?
Well, one of the things that you pointed out already that I think really drives a lot of this is that Americans tend to forget that while it's an authoritarian political system inside Russia, it's still a political system. And Vladimir
Absolutely.
Putin is often responding to his internal need to maintain himself and his government and his regime in power. And I'll play another clip from Khodorkovsky where he made that point, where he said, you know, look, this is Vladimir Putin's campaign platform is America bashing. When he's fighting in Syria, when he's fighting in Ukraine, he's fighting against the big bad West. It's a war between Russia and the West. It's not a war between Russians and Ukrainians.
Yeah, I think that's a very key thing to understand. When you're in Russia, what you hear about is, did Putin do this for external consumption or internal consumption? And a lot of, I think what we don't understand is that a lot of times the song is not about us. A lot of times it's done for an internal audience to shore up his domestic support. I mean, I think it's really telling that much of the Russian news today is not really about what's happening in Russia, not about a stagnant economy, not about corruption, not about rotten infrastructure. It's about the West or about Russia's exploits abroad. And it's about this bait and switch of, you know, Putin's original contract with the Russian people was, you guys get wealthy or you become better off, I'll help you do that, but you, in return, you stay out of politics and you leave that to me.
I called that his Make Russia Great Again strategy.
Right. And then when he returned to power in 2012, widely seen as an illegitimate return to power for his third term as president, he took on a more ideological, more revanchist kind of approach. And it became about, you know, the economy's not doing great, but that's okay because we're an empire again. We're great again. We are challenging the West. We're not dancing to their tune. We're not being humiliated by them and told what to do. And it's amazing how much it really resonates with Russians, how much it's important to them, the same way it's important to Americans to live in a great power.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because that was a theme of Vladimir Putin from the very beginning. So I was there in Moscow for the first 4 years, basically, of Putin's presidency, when he certainly didn't have the international capabilities that he has now to basically intervene in the war in Syria, to intervene and to create a civil war on the ground in Ukraine. Back in the early 2000s, Russia really was much more of a basket case. In fact, people were still debating over, you know, could they repay the Soviet debt in time? People were still debating over what kind of identity Putin would bring to the office of the president. And there was it was an identity crisis, basically. You know, we weren't sure what had happened in the first 10 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But we were pretty sure we didn't like it. And Putin came in and he played off of those feelings of insecurity and instability on the part of the Russian people. He said, things are going to be stable again. But the thing that I remember so vividly that's relevant to today's conversation was that at the beginning, Putin really was about restoring the Russian state internally, rebuilding power in the Kremlin. He used to call it the vertical of Vlast, the basically the vertical of power. And, you know, looking internally, consolidating authority, eliminating the democracy that had taken hold, if tenuously, in the first 10 years.
Bringing oligarchs under control.
Absolutely. Bringing oligarchs under control, bringing the media under control. So that was a story of the four-year period when I was there. I think what we missed, or that Putin wasn't yet ready for, was this much more internationally aggressive leader that we have today. He's now taken over Crimea. That was the first armed annexation of territory since the end of World War II. So my question to you is, going forward, do you believe that now that Putin has another six-year term under his belt, is he going to be more aggressive again internationally? Is he going to aggressively seek to revise international borders, to challenge the United States and the West elsewhere?
I think the answer, unfortunately, is yes. I remember in 2012, 2013, when the Russian economy started its kind of long decline, Russians who were very kind of smart watching what was happening and very kind of in tune with what was happening politically were saying, you know, as Russia gets poorer internally, it's going to become more aggressive externally. And I think that has very much borne out, been borne out since 2014 and the annexation of Crimea and the invasion of eastern Ukraine. Then you have Syria. You have the meddling in elections all over Europe and in the U.S., most recently being the Catalan independence movement. You know, so there's no kind of no referendum issue too small for Putin to get his hands in and try to kind of chip away at the transatlantic alliance or order. I think Syria and the Middle East are going to be a very interesting area to watch. Russia is, you know, now heading up the peace talks in Syria, bringing both the Turks and the Iranians to the table. America is not in those conversations at all anymore. We used to be helping to run the Geneva talks. Now they've been moved to Astana in Central Asia. You know, Russia's, you know, former Soviet republic. Russia talks to all sides in the Middle East. It's seen now, instead of the U.S., is seen as a kind of reliable ally.
And by the way, just this week, I should point out, you have this incredible visual image of Donald Trump saying, on the one hand, I want to get out of Syria immediately, as soon as possible, never mind what his advisor said or what the American policy has been. Same day, you have this incredible visual of Vladimir Putin convening regional leaders. To me, that was almost the visual representation of the post-American world order.
And it's also kind of a an embodiment of what Vladimir Putin wants to be and how he wants to be seen both domestically and abroad. He wants to be seen as the great diplomat and peacemaker and also aggressor. So somebody who is capable, who is really good with all the tools in that toolbox, that he can go to war if necessary and push back, but he is primarily the only adult in the room. He's not going to start crazy, stupid wars like the Americans did in Iraq, which is constantly brought up by the Russians when they admonish the Americans, he can convene all sides and be seen as an honest broker who actually follows through.
So I think this notion of Vladimir Putin exactly as he wants to be seen is a great pivot to how he is seen in the United States today and this Russiagate investigation. Because, you know, we're talking about Russia right now, but an awful lot of what passes for Russia conversation in Washington today in American politics is really not about Russia. It's about Russiagate or whatever you want to call it. It's about the Russian intervention in the 2016 U.S. elections, the ongoing investigations of it by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and in particular by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. This, of course, from the very beginning of this Global Politico podcast, has been a subject of ongoing and recurring conversation, both because it radically affects how Vladimir Putin is seen in the United States. How does he want to be seen? Why did he intervene in our election? Did he get what he wanted with Donald Trump? And then again, the seriousness of this investigation. We've learned an awful lot in the course of the last year. When we started out at the Global Politico, we would have been astonished to know a lot of the information that has subsequently come out about contacts between the Trump campaign and various Russian envoys, emissaries, spies, and the like. We would be amazed to have learned, for example, about that summer 2016 Trump Tower meeting in which Russians were openly promising dirt on Hillary Clinton to President Trump's own son and his top campaign officials. So let's talk Russiagate for a few minutes. And also, you know, what the Obama and Trump administrations did and didn't do about that. When I had Victoria Nuland on this show, she talked about the spidey sense of the Russia experts inside the U.S. government and how the hairs on the back of their necks were standing up when they started to realize in 2016 that Russia was running the same play inside the United States that it had run in many Eastern European countries already, intervening in their politics. And yet we didn't seem to recognize it.
So I think, again, this goes back to the idea of who is a worthy adversary to the U.S. You know, I think it the level of disbelief was also driven, in fact, by, you know, well, we're not Germany and we're not France and we're certainly not Hungary. This can't happen here. And in fact, it did. And as we're realizing also with all the disclosures about Cambridge Analytica and the role that Facebook played and earlier the revelations about the role that Twitter played and just the role of, you know, political advertising, we're realizing that in some ways the Russians played the role of terrorists. They used our system, our own tools against us. They were able to manipulate these openings and these platforms into pretty daft weapons.
You know, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I've been so struck by that. At the height of the Cold War, imagine that you told KGB agent Vladimir Putin or any of his bosses, America itself is going to invent a tool by which you can have direct access to basically every single American, certainly every single American you'd like to reach. It's basically going to be so cheap as to be free. And we will even sell you and help guide you to have the most effective use of this tool.
And you'll be able to mask yourself.
Not only that, but we're going to tell you exactly what these Americans like, what they think about, who their friends are, and what kind of messages would most appeal to them.
Right. And American society will be so divided and fraught at the time that it'll be a total cakewalk to divide them further and to fan kind of the flames of division, which is kind of how, you know, as I...
Yeah, it would have been a KGB officer's dream.
Yeah. I mean, I've spoken to former NSA head Michael Hayden about this, and he said, you know, the best covert operations, they don't create facts or divisions on the ground. They exacerbate the ones that are already there. And in some ways, 2016 was perfect. It was this kind of perfect storm, and the Russians just were able to push it in just the right direction. I think what we still don't know, to me, this is the most interesting question. Also, the question that probably is completely unanswerable is, what impact did it have on the election? You know, did people stay home and not vote because they were, you know, Bernie supporters and they were disgusted by the DNC, you know, what came out in the DNC hack? Did people come out and vote more for Trump because they saw these ads saying that Hillary was going to let in all these Muslims, right, or all these illegal immigrants? It's so hard to gauge, right, because it's everybody's decision to vote is so multifaceted and multifactorial. And that's, I think, part of the brilliance of this operation. And also because it was an operation that was, as you know, one former Obama official said, was like throwing spaghetti at the wall. They were trying all kinds of different things. And I think this is what we also, just going back to what we don't understand about the Russians, we think of it as, you know, because the way we Americans would do it, we would, you know, have a clear hierarchy, a clear plan. There would be kind of everybody would be unified in their mission and their idea of what everybody's doing. But in fact, one hand in Russia, one hand didn't know what the other hand was doing. And there was a lot of turf battles going on, as we now know, some of from some terrific reporting from Russian reporters, what's left of them. And the fact that actually the Russian strength was in their disorganization, in their flexibility, in their high appetite for risk, and the fact that they were willing to try crazy things and pivot as the situation merited, that was actually their strength.
Right. Well, combined with the still unknown questions of how much help they received in targeting and distributing this information, either by the Trump campaign or those associated with it. And that, of course, is what still remains up in the air. And your
But also the other thing is that that's also hard to determine, right? Even if they did have help from the Trump organization, and it seems that the Trump organization was happy to take help from anybody, the question is, was that the deciding factor? Or, you know, because of the internet, in addition to, like, if you went back to, you know, 1983 and talked to KGB agent Vladimir Putin, you're like, on top of this tool called, they're going to call it Facebook, they're also going to invent this thing called the internet, and they're going to put all their political information online. You don't even need spies in Russia. They can just sit in Moscow.
Or St. Petersburg. The Internet Research Agency.
Right, and read, you know, and read the New York Times and Politico and Cook's Political Report and watch, you know, all these TV channels through the internet. You don't even have to go there and flip sources. You know, all this information about what districts to target, about what states are up in the air, what issues are driving the conversation and are really pitting Americans against each other. It's just going to be, you're just going to have this little screen, and it's going to be at the at your fingertips, literally.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. But we're still talking about the narrow question of the 2016 election and where votes weighed, and in some ways it's very unknowable. There's two other elements of this we haven't really talked about. Number one, which is how much will it directly reach the level of criminal activity? How much will it directly reach?
And it already has,
the level,
as we've seen.
Exactly. So Mueller has already issued criminal indictments. There have already been guilty pleas in the case. But it still hasn't fundamentally yet answered the question of to what extent U.S. persons, and specifically those associated with the Trump campaign, including the president himself, did they know about this and were they involved in it? So that's where we all sense there's a potential political explosion coming down the road. And then there's this question of, and so what? What is the United States supposed to do about this? And did the Obama administration handle it correctly? Was it proactive and aggressive enough in responding to it? And then, of course, what's happened since then? You and I are talking on a day when there are a whole wave of new sanctions that have been finally released that target Putin's inner circle in response to this. But for God's sakes, we're talking about this is the spring of 2018, and this intervention occurred starting in late 2014, according to Bob Mueller.
And as some people have pointed out, by the time these sanctions came out, mostly against oligarchs, they have had plenty of time to restructure their assets in a way where they'll be minimally affected by the sanctions. Still, I think it's quite a strong signal. And I think the kind of underexplored and undernoticed area that I think a lot of this will come down to is the money aspect. You know, it's a truism in journalism, and it's truer than ever, you know, follow the money. And there was a story you and I talked about that came out last month on a weekend, pretty unnoticed, a Reuters investigation that rich Russians bought about $100 million of property, of Trump property in South Florida alone. And you know, this has been kind of bandied about on political talk shows here about whether or not basically Donald Trump was essentially a laundromat for dirty Russian money because he didn't ask too many questions and needed the money because American banks wouldn't lend to him. But given how, you know, and this was one of the first ways that contemporary Russians took advantage of the American political system is they make their money at home and then get it out of the country into the West using all the things we invented almost for them, you know, LLCs, American law firms buying their property for them that are then protected by attorney-client privilege, you know, LLCs that buy LLCs that buy LLCs that buy, you know, some property
right.
in
so
Trump Tower.
You can never track it back.
So you can and it's, you know, if you don't have, you know, I've been joking with some journalist friends that if I had a superpower, I'd want subpoena power because – otherwise, it's really impossible to follow the money these days. And I think that's one of the avenues that is going to become more kind of fleshed out and filled in as the Mueller investigation continues, I hope, because I think there's going to be a lot there.
So one of the things in the year since we've been talking about Russia and the Russiagate investigation on the Global Politico, one of the interesting things is that the politics surrounding it on both right and left have kind of gotten scrambled. And you have this element of what I would call sort of Mueller denialism that exists on the left as well as the right. People saying basically Russiagate is a distraction. It's not that serious. You know, we shouldn't care about it. We should really focus either on the actual threats from Russia or on the problems of President Trump from the point of view of the left don't have to do with Russia. They have to do with what Trump is doing in the United States. Where do you come down on that debate? Because it's a pretty fierce one already.
Yeah. And it has been from the moment it kind of broke. You know, I'm kind of two minds about it. I think that it has gotten – the debate around it has gotten so politicized. And, you know, if you're in one camp, you have to say and believe the following things. And if you're in the other, you have to say and believe another set of facts. Or beliefs. And I think the problem lies in the fact that it has become about Trump. And Trump and Republicans feel this, and so they push back. That it's, you know, they feel maybe correctly that this is Democrats kind of wanting a do-over. And or at the very least undermining Trump's legitimacy. And unfortunately, yes, it is about Trump because it was an election in which he won in a really strange way. He lost the popular vote by a massive amount of votes and then squeak through in these areas that were completely unexpected. You know, they were the blue Democrat, the Democratic wall in the upper Midwest. So it is about Trump, but I think the media and Democrats have, and I hate to lump them together, but I think they have kind of failed to make the debate about, not about Trump, about national security, about the integrity of our elections, about the fact that they'll do this to anybody. They'll do this to Republicans, too, if they find that they're being too hawkish on Russia or if they want to just stir up more chaos and make – you know, I remember watching the Roy Moore
election in Alabama.
And I just thought this is so perfect, right? All of America is watching this race in Alabama while Russia's just cleaning up in the Middle East at very low cost. Very low cost. Like all of this, you know, all of our fears of intervention in Syria, Russia has shown that you can do quite effectively with very few men on the ground and very little money, actually. So, you know, and and meddling in the Catalan independence movement.
Right, so it's internal distraction.
Right, we just become, because we're prone to it, the same way the Russians are prone to it. We're a big country with imperial ambitions and this kind of imperialness in our DNA, the way that Russians are, and it's very easy for us to turn inward and become obsessed with our own internal struggles and not notice, you know, that the Russian thief is out back, you know, cleaning out your chicken coop. I don't know where that analogy came from, but there it is.
Well, all right. So let's talk about Trump. It is about Trump. You know, I think that's sort of our third and final, you know, aspect of our conversation today, because you can't really talk about Russia and Trump without talking about what is inside his mind. And what is with his admiration for Vladimir Putin? It was at the very beginning of the Global Politico, we had Bob Corker on the show, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And this is before he publicly broke with Trump. At the time, he was still talking with Trump a lot, and he was desperately trying to get inside his mind and to figure out what, you know, what's going on. And we talked with Corker, and, you know, he had talked with Trump about Putin. And Corker said, you know, I have to say, I'm sorry to say it, I do think that it's a degree of admiration for strongman.
This will probably get me in a lot of trouble. But I think in many ways the president views himself as someone who has the ability to overcome every obstacle and to do something that no other president has been able to do. And I think that's the way he views himself as it relates to his legacy and how history will view him. And so he looks at Russia, looks at Putin, he looks at the relationship that we have. I do think there is a degree of admiration for a strong man. I'm sorry.
My goodness, that was back in January, February of 2017. Here we are in April of 2018. Flash forward, Donald Trump has never to this day said something publicly critical of Vladimir Putin.
As someone pointed out to me the other day, he is literally meaner to Meryl Streep than he is to Vladimir Putin, which is really quite something. And you know, on one hand, I think Corker is absolutely right. I think he has an abiding fascination with and admiration for strongmen. He has been similarly kind to President Xi of China, Duterte of the Philippines, Erdogan of Turkey. He thinks that that's a good way to run a country. You know, he has attempted a kind of a much paler version of what these guys do of, you know, undermining the independent press. You know, when SNL was mean to him in the very beginning of his administration, he publicly called into question NBC's broadcasting license. Very similar to those guys. That said, Erdogan, Xi, and Duterte did not intervene in the 2016 election with the overt goal of helping him win, right? So it becomes even more problematic that he won't say anything about Russia. Especially because Russia continues to do crazy things.
Well, there's also this striking, call it a bifurcation, split screen situation that's developed where it's been one of the most revealing aspects of the gap between Donald Trump and Donald Trump's administration when it comes to foreign policy. And so you have this relatively hawkish foreign policy on Russia that's more or less supported by Democrats and Republicans. And you have the spectacle of the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, before he was unceremoniously dumped by Trump. His last words out the door this week were a warning that the United States had failed to, in his view, adequately respond to the Russian provocations.
Or Rex Tillerson. I mean, this to me was just
Of the Order of Friendship
from
Russia.
Vladimir Putin himself, who with his own hands pinned that thing on Tillerson's lapel, that medal on Tillerson's lapel, and that he, you know, the last thing he does, or it turns out that it's the last thing he does, that he says, basically he calls out Russia for the poisoning of this former Russian spy in the UK, and then is unceremoniously dumped by President Trump the next day. And I'm just getting goosebumps thinking about it all over again, because it's just, you know, if you're a Russiagate skeptic, which I definitely was at the beginning, it's like there's increasingly less room for skepticism, because how do you explain that? It just, even the optics of it are so bad, you know, that he's pushed out everybody who's hawkish on Russia, or that he does these things, you know, again, you and I have talked about this a lot, about this split, right, between the Trump administration, which says, do not congratulate when you talk to Putin.
These are the famous talking points that were leaked to the Washington Post and probably sped up the firing of H.R. McMaster.
Probably. This was the call that Trump made to Putin after his quote-unquote election on March 18th, where he squeaked by with a nail-biting 77% of the vote. And it, again, came after the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter with a military-grade nerve agent. And the note said, the talking point said, do not congratulate in capital letters. What does Trump do? He congratulates Putin.
Not only that, but he invites him to the White House.
Well, then we find this out from the Russians.
Right.
And as always, we keep finding out, you know, the Russians are – so this is what I was getting to. Like the – you know, and then Trump congratulates him. The talking points say, please scold him for the poisoning. He doesn't scold him. In fact, he invites him to a White House visit, not just a visit. And the Russians are very ably playing off of this split, you know, where he's basically given them a big opening to walk right into. And they're very ably, you know, playing the administration off the president that heads it to their own advantage, because, you know, the Russians, like the Chinese, love protocol. All of these state visits are very important to them. The optics are very important to them, especially for Vladimir Putin, who wants to make Russia great again, who wants Russia to be seen as a peer to the U.S. and not as the junior partner in the relationship that is to be punished for things. What better image is there for him after, you know, all of these diplomatic expulsions, after all these sanctions, after – again, a poisoning on UK territory with a crazy nerve agent, that he gets a photo op with the president of the US in the White House that the president of the US invited him to. But there's nothing more legitimizing than that for the Russians. They're getting exactly what they want out of this.
Even if the meeting never occurs, the timing of the leak coming from the Russians was very clearly weaponizing information that Trump himself had handed them. Why did they do it?
It's not the first time they've done it.
And they did it to make it clear to people like us who are paying attention that Donald Trump is not on the same page with the tough policies coming out of his administration, number one. Number two, that Donald Trump continues almost to this day to be privately acting in a very conciliatory fashion towards Vladimir Putin, and in fact even seeking his approval. And Trump followed it up, by the way, rather than being ashamed or trying to hide this. What did Trump do? I think it's very notable that he spoke out publicly later, and basically not only he confirmed it by saying, well, yeah, you know, shouldn't we get along with Russia? Which is what he's been saying ever since the campaign.
That's right.
He's never changed his rhetoric if you actually look at what Trump himself is saying.
It's one of the very few things on which he's been absolutely consistent. And the other thing, for example, that the Russians noticed and weaponized last summer, when Congress passed, this completely broken Congress passed with a veto-proof majority, a mandate for new Russia sanctions. And Trump made several public statements about it, saying he doesn't like this bill. He doesn't want to do sanctions against Russia. The Russian political media made so much hay of it. I mean, all, you know, Russian politicians up and down the power vertical, all of Russian TV was crowing about how the president of the U.S. wants to be friends, but the deep state is hamstringing him and is just pointlessly against Russia, just irrationally against Russia.
Well, so this leads to the bigger frame question. If we agree, as it seems that we do, that, you know, Trump has never wavered in his either admiration for Putin or desire somehow to reset relations, even though politically that's become very unrealistic, where does that leave the two countries? There's been this sort of long debate that actually predates Donald Trump, but has certainly flared up anew since the election, over whether or not we are in a state of essentially a new Cold War with Russia. And, you know, everybody has a point of view on it. I've written a long piece about it. My basic takeaway is that, you know, the terminology isn't all that helpful because the first Cold War was plenty bad, and it existed in a totally different both media and information and military context, where there could be clear dividing lines between Russia and the West in a way that the current world is no longer so neat.
And there were kind of rules and protocols of what you do, you know, especially by the latter phase of the Cold War.
Well, that's right. But even if you don't like the terminology, as I know, clearly the situation between the two countries is as hostile, if not more so, than at any period since the late Cold War. Arguably, during the tenure of Mikhail Gorbachev, we were on much better terms as a country during the, say, the George H.W. Bush administration, even during the second Reagan administration, on much better terms with the Soviet Union than we are with Russia today. So how do you view that? And what are the meaningful prospects? I mean, how scared should we be by this level of hostility?
Personally, I'm very scared. And the one question I'll add to the outstanding question is Donald Trump's motivations, you know, for this consistently laudatory rhetoric toward Russia and Putin. And I think we still don't know the answer to that. But about the, you know,
why are you very scared?
Why, the reason I'm scared is because, like I said, I think in the Cold War, there were kind of protocols and rules developed and lines of communication, and there were just the way things were done on the Soviet side and on the Russian side. Now you have kind of flimsier systems in place. There are fewer rules, and you have two guys, Trump and Putin, who are both painted into a corner strategically. Both at home and geopolitically, who are very prideful, both very kind of emotional, knee-jerk decision makers to an extent. And I worry that they're both going to start clawing their way out of their respective corners and that that's going to lead to a lot of collateral damage. I also worry that Putin, you know, this isn't his first rodeo and this is not his first U.S. president, whereas Trump is still kind of getting his sea legs. And this is kind of the built-in advantage of an autocratic system where, you know, Putin already knows how to do all this and he's kind of a better tactician and kind of a better strategist. And I worry that in this showdown, Putin's going to outmaneuver Trump and the U.S.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Before he was thrown out, H.R. McMaster authored a new national security strategy for the United States. And it's actually very similar to the new national defense strategy penned by Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. And they lump Russia together with China and basically say the age of counterterrorism post 9/11 obsession is over and we have to return and renew a focus as a country on the challenges that come from great powers, Russia and China, that we're in a new era of competition with Russia and China. And arguably, that's an era that began before Donald Trump. It's likely to continue after Trump has left office, whenever that is. And so, you know, what I'm struck by is that Americans, even if you put aside this question of Donald Trump, they're not really prepared for that kind of a confrontation. And right now, of course, you don't really have a president who is leading or shaping that, you know, Barack Obama didn't buy into that either, by the way. Yeah. Many of his advisors did. But Barack Obama demeaned and belittled Russia and basically dismissed them as insignificant in the sweep of history, a finished and doomed
Which
former
kind of
superpower.
Which exacerbated the problem.
Right. So, you know, the issue is, do we really buy and accept this notion that rather than America as the lone superpower going forward, we have entered the post-American age, the age when we will struggle. Not that we won't be a power, but that when we will struggle and compete with other powers like China and Russia for dominance.
Well, this has been a thing that Vladimir Putin has been remarkably consistent about. And in 2007, when he spoke at the Munich Security Conference, he said that basically the liberal order that was established in 1991 at the end of the Cold War is over and we don't agree to it and we want to rediscuss and renegotiate the terms of surrender.
Yeah, so now
no
we're
more
unipolar.
Yeah, no more unipolar world where America calls all the shots with no friction, because we've seen, I mean, this was happening in 2007 again, 4 years after the invasion of Iraq and 6 years after the invasion of Afghanistan. And one of which, the invasion of Iraq, Putin was firmly against. And at that point, he had been kind of been proven right. Things had spiraled out of control in Iraq. And he said, you know, that's it. No more. You guys can't just go around doing whatever you want. Especially you can't call the shots on who gets to rule which country. And I think that's what Syria is about. It's kind of drawing a line and saying America cannot say so-and-so must go. It's just not within their power. And we have something to say about that, too. And we will push back in a very real way.
So welcome to the future, which is we will.
He's achieved it. Yeah.
We will compete with Russia and China for influence, authority, power, and advantage, whether military or economic.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's helpful to, you know, getting back to your very first question about the often ignorant way in which Russia is discussed in Washington. I think it's not just about, you know, pride of intellect and expertise. It's about accurately diagnosing the problem and knowing what it is you're dealing with, right? You don't want to treat a broken leg with chemotherapy.
Well, and that's because it really brings us right back to the modern version of Kremlinology, which is what's inside the head of Vladimir Putin, what's inside the head of Donald Trump at this key moment in time. And I'll leave the final word actually to another friend of ours, Anne Applebaum, in the conversation that she and I had a few months ago on the Global Politico. She said, well, you know, we actually have a clearer sense at this point in time of what Russia's intentions are than we do of what Washington and what Donald Trump is going to do about it. And, you know, imagine if we were fighting the Cold War all over again, except only one side was fighting it. And I think that's an important question to leave us with. My guest this week on the Global Politico is Julia Yaffe, as well as all of you listeners who have been wonderful and kind and smart and really offered a lot of great insights and feedback over the course of the last year as we have taken the Global Politico on the road. We've always returned to Russia and Russiagate over and over and over again, which is why we have this final Russia, Russia, Russia episode of the Global Politico. So thank you, Julia, for being our guest, and thank you to all of you listeners.
Thank you, Susan.